This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free Blackstone 8-piece accessory kit when you buy a Blackstone 28-inch griddle. Plus, get two free select Craftsman V20 tools when you buy an RP brushless drill and impact driver combo kit. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Hello and welcome to episode 51 of the Desi Outsiders podcast. I'm Meenal.
And I'm Ankita.
And this week we're speaking to Kirti Jayakumar, an Indian women's rights activist, a social entrepreneur, a peace activist, an artist, lawyer and writer, among many other things. I could sit here all day and name every single one of her achievements, but to put it simply, her hard work landed her the US Presidential Services Medal in 2011.
Kirti is the founder of the Red Elephant Foundation, an initiative that advocates for peace and gender equality by means of storytelling. She's also authored two collections of short stories, Stories of Hope, published in 2013, and The Dove's Lament, published in 2015, and she has co-authored and contributed to over 10 fiction and non-fiction books.
The list of Kirti's achievements is almost endless, but in this interview, we get into all the influences that made her want to do the work that she does today. A lawyer who left her corporate job within just 1 month and went on to volunteer with many NGOs, including the UN. Kirti revealed right at the very beginning of our interview that she's a victim of rape, and this was a huge surprise to us. Conversation took a completely unexpected turn, and here we have an amazing story to share. So stay tuned right until the end. We promise you that it really is worth it.
So welcome to the show, Kirti. It's such a pleasure to have you with us here today. You know, Meenal and I are actually feeling a bit overwhelmed, as I told you earlier, because usually our structure for this podcast is to go through an individual's life story from the beginning to the end to understand how they got to where they are. But with you, we have so many things to ask, so much area to cover. We're feeling that 60 minutes won't really be enough to go through everything.
Well, that is so kind of you. First of all, thank you so much for having me here. I feel like this fizz ball of energy around me with all the amazing things that the both of you do. So I think it works both ways. I wish I could be the one asking questions.
Wow, that's so kind of you, Kirti. But without wasting too much time on us, let's get right into it and let's tell all the listeners about your story. So, you know, needless to say, there is so much that you have achieved as an individual a young age, you know, the age of 30. And when I saw you about a couple of months ago, I, in my head, you know, sort of computed as, oh yeah, Kirti is the founder of the Red Elephant Foundation. Then I read you studied law, and then you studied in Costa Rica, and then I heard about your writing, and then Ankita told me about your anti-bullying campaign, and now I'm just exhausted from listing everything. But before we get into all of that, Kirti, let's go back to your childhood, where it all, I guess, presumably started. You know, you were raised in Bangalore with your grandparents whilst your parents and brother were in Chennai. So why were you away from your immediate family?
Oh, actually, no. I wasn't raised in Bangalore with my parents away in Chennai. It's just that I used to spend a large part of my childhood in Bangalore over summer vacations and other times of the year. So most times what would usually happen is that because my brother was younger, I used to remain in the care of my grandparents while my parents would be with my brother. So my childhood years, I think, would for the most part account for being the regular normal childhood in terms of school and just the 10,000 questions children would ask. But at one point in my journey, the abuse began. I faced rape and sexual abuse as a child at the hands of some people I knew and was related to, and some people I was not related to. But at every turn in each of these incidents, I was always told to keep quiet because there would be consequences. And when you're little and the other people are all big and they're scary people, you don't want to take them on. And so you kind of buy into that silence a little bit. And then one point came when it was too much to take that I rebelled and I said, okay, if you really want to kill me, if those are the consequences you're going to throw my way, just do it. But they turned heel and they said that if you are going to speak up about it, we're going to hurt your brother. And then the stakes grew up because I couldn't stand anyone so much as even laying a finger on my younger brother. So I remained a very quiet child. But I suppose in hindsight, a lot of what happened to me manifested as a bit of the symptoms that would come out. I was a moody child. I was a quiet child. I would not really engage too much. I was a lonely child. I didn't make too many friends. But as a consequence, at school, that was seen as being a good target. So I became a target of a lot of bullying, a lot of violence at school. I was beaten up at different times. I was also made fun of for my appearance because I was on the heavier side and I had dark skin. It was like this obsession in Indian society with fair skin or white skin, as they call it. So between all of that, somehow I managed to grow up reading Anne Frank's diary almost with a kind of devotion since the day I turned 13. I would read it once every year. And somehow I made it to college where, again, I kind of assumed that things would be a lot better. But then I was targeted this time for my ethnicity, for my caste. And for want of a better way of putting it, I would say it's probably a racial kind of violence. So our Western audiences could understand it. So I was beaten up again. I was left on the side of the street with my nose broken because of my caste identity. And I couldn't really approach the administration because they wouldn't do anything about it. They said so in so many words. So I kind of had to push through, power through law school as well without too much sort of going for me in terms of peace of mind. But I managed to get out of all of it. I started volunteering with the UN online. And that's when I sort of began my career personally. And I think in many ways, my career takes off and gives back to my childhood in so many different ways.
Oh my God, Kirti, I'm just like blown away by the story because I was just going to ask you, you know, you're such a perceptive and empathetic person. You know, in your TED talk, you spoke about a little girl who was bullied and you asked her, does this happen to you often? And she just responded with a little nod and you immediately related to her because you yourself were a victim of bullying. And I was going to ask you more about this bullying, but to think that this is your story, it's just, you know, it's such a common thing in Indian society and Desi cultures to see when you're a victim, when something happens to you, there's so much shame associated with that, as if you brought this upon yourself. And there's a very cultural aspect of this that I want to get into right now with you, which is that the other day we spoke to Jayashree Mishra and she was talking about how her child has special needs. And a lot of people in Kerala would say, this is as a result of the past sins from your, you know, past life. Did you ever face something of that sort? That were you ever shamed for what happened to you?
Yes and no. I would say yes, because everybody beyond my immediate circle did have some kind of, but what were you wearing? Where were you going? Why were you in that place by yourself? What time of the day was it? Why did you get out of the house in the first place? So those were things I was asked. But my immediate circle, which comprises my mum, my dad, my brother, and my grandparents, there were no questions asked. They were, in fact, one of the biggest sounding boards for me, because when I came out with my story, my family didn't know any of this until I turned 25, which was 5 years ago. And I told my mother first, and my mother is an alternative healer and a life coach, and she helps a lot of people really transition from trauma to a place of healing. So when my mother heard all of this, she just completely disconnected being the mother and became the therapist. And it was amazing, because even now when I go back to sort of revisit the kind of resilience she showed that day to help me get out of this, I don't think any human being is capable of it. Honestly, I mean, I know I'm probably sounding like I'm fangirling with my mom or something, but that's something one has to see. But yeah.
And Kirti, if I may ask, how old were you when you had to go through this, and how long did it take for you to be comfortable speaking about this openly?
So I was 5 years old when I was first raped. And then for about 8 years after that, I was sexually abused by different people, but at least a couple of times each year. And the bullying started in between. It's an overlap when I was 9 years old. And it went on all the way until I was 15, which was when we were about to leave school. And then following that, college, of course, which is all through, because it's a five-year law school course. So that covered between 16 and 21. So, yeah.
Well, Kirti, I'm sorry. It's just like, it's quite overwhelming to hear all of this, you know, because, you know, we're in the hospital and we're in pediatrics, for example, and we see these five-year-old kids running around and, you know, with their parents. And then you say this sort of thing happened to you at the age of five. So it kind of like, you know, my heart just sort of sank right now just to think about that. But I did want to ask about what really ignited such a powerful passion to work as an activist and a social reformist to this extent, Kirti, because, you know, a lot of people are involved, like Ankita and I are involved in, you know, spreading powerful stories and powerful messages, but we don't do it to the extent that you're doing. You know, you go through every single aspect and you make sure that you cover all grounds as much as possible. So was it solely your experiences as a child that has made you work this way, or is it more to do with your experiences and other things that you've seen around you as well?
I think I'll start by saying everything starts from within. I know I'm going to sound a little philosophical when I make this reference, but you know, I'm very driven by different principles that I pull out from different religions. And one thing that I've understood across all religions is that everything that's happening outside you is happening inside you. So I think in some ways, the little girl, the five-year-old girl, the eight-year-old girl, the nine-year-old girl inside of me is seeking closure, is seeking healing. And I think one way in which she can find healing at different ages is going to be able to solve something around her. And I'm not saying I have all the solutions or that I'm ever going to have all the solutions, but I at least want to try. And I suppose that's the idea, basically. And I'm not even worried I'm going to sound selfish when I say this, but I'm really, really sort of pushing as much as I can, because I want to be able to look back and tell my younger self that it does get better. But on a more pragmatic note, I would say that there's also the truth that everyday things that happen around me do trigger me. For instance, last evening we had the news that there was a horrific rape in public in broad daylight that took place in a city in India called Vizag.
Yeah.
And instead of intervening, there were people who filmed the entire thing. Nobody did anything to the woman. And this happened in a crowded railway station. A man, a 23-year-old man, walks up to this woman and just begins to rape her, and nobody did anything.
In a railway station.
There was footage of people just simply walking past this as if nothing was happening.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
Exactly. And it's terrible. It's chilling, because if we've come to this level where something that's happening in front of us doesn't kind of make us want to sort of intervene, throw ourselves into the situation, then I think we've lost our humanity. So I think I would quote Kailash Satyarthi when I say that I get angry, but I use that anger. And it's good to be angry.
Yeah, and I think this idea of, you know, someone being raped in a railway station and people just walking by, it's really sad for me to say, but I think to some extent, a lot of us, not just in India, but even outside India, if we hear of another rape case or we hear of another sort of violence abuse, we're like, yeah, just another one. And I think that's what was going through those people's minds who were just walking past this victim or walking past this scene, like, yeah, it's just something else that's just happening again. And I think it's really important that, you know, the work that you do and the work that everybody else is doing right now is to sort of change that mindset that it's not okay and it's not normal.
I mean, the number of times these kind of instances are brought to light, it does make you realize the magnitude of the problem. But at the same time, I think the public is starting to get desensitized to these issues, because it's like, it's becoming the new norm. And that is the saddest thing that we're having to discuss right now.
You know, you're right about it, but I also think it's not just about desensitization. I think it's also about bystander fear. Because for a large amount of time, people have always mistrusted the police and the security sector, because the first reaction is, oh, they're not going to do anything and I'm going to be caught and asking to give evidence and I don't want to be part of this. So I think that fear has also been one of the biggest issues. So I suppose blaming the public and the bystanders for not being interveners is one part of it, but also kind of questioning what kind of rapport and social confidence building measures exist is also something we should be doing.
Yes, because I remember specifically, this is something that I heard when I was growing up in Kerala, that whenever there was a accident in the highway, a lot of people were reluctant to take the victims to the hospital because the people who arrived with the victims, whether it's a body or whether it's just an injured person, those people would be detained for an entire day, questioned and whatnot, and ultimately they would have to end up paying a fine in some rare cases. So people were just scared that if we help someone, we will get into trouble inadvertently, so might as well just stay out of it and mind our own business. And it's just so many levels of reform that needs to take place for something like this to not happen.
That is really true. I think we need to have a complete systemic overhaul, right from educating people to the service providers themselves.
So, Kirti, so going back to your TED talk that I just mentioned earlier, it emphasizes the importance of starting young, of educating children about peace and mutual respect alongside their regular curriculum of science, math, physics, whatever. So this is something that we on Desi Outsiders have always discussed and been really interested in. Like, how can we make the future generations better? So, but, you know, putting this idea out there that you have to make the future generations better is one thing, but actually implementing this change is a completely other aspect. So what, according to you, is the most foolproof way of ensuring this kind of a positive change in our education system?
So I'll be honest to admit that even though I do have a fair idea of what has worked, I couldn't tell you that it's foolproof because you always have exceptions for every norm.
Yes.
But I would start by saying that if we want to educate the future generation, we need to start with the present, because a child is only going to see things around him or her and grow up to be in that space and occupy those values in some way. So even if we're going to start by teaching children the right kind of messages, the right kind of approaches, the right kind of critical evaluation of things that the child is engaging with, we must also work with their parents and with their teachers. Because if we, for instance, are going to tell a classroom of young people, men, women, and all other genders are absolutely equal and nothing is more or less than the other, but if the child is going home with a parent who sees a transgender or a trans woman on the street and tells her child to look away, then the entire messaging that we've spent all day sort of giving the child is completely destroyed. Because the child is going to not just forget about what you've told them, because that's how children's memory spans up. They're also going to pick up the dominant message, which is their mother's, because the mother is a constant influence that the child would want to be on the good books. So we need to have a systemic approach. We need to teach our parents the kind of vocabulary they need to use with their children. We need to get our teachers to really think about things they say. If a young boy in their class is crying, it's wrong for a teacher to say something like, "Don't cry like a girl." Yes. So every little microaggression has to have a complete overhaul. And until we do that, we're not going to be able to make any difference at all.
So coming to your Red Elephant Foundation, you know, first of all, it's such an interesting choice of name for your nonprofit. So how did you come up with it?
So the first thing that struck me when we look at organizations that are creating change is that they're always called something institute or something foundation, something center for something, society for something. It was always very intimidating to me. I wanted it to be fun. I wanted it to be a character. I wanted it to be something people would relate to. So that was the first process. And the second thing was, very selfishly, I love elephants and I wanted to name it something to do with elephants. And so I just decided arbitrarily that it would be Red Elephant. And so the meaning was something I thought of after I created it, because red is a color that you don't forget. It's a color that strikes you. And elephants have phenomenal memories. So we were telling stories that we didn't want people to forget, number one. Number two, interesting story is that elephants are a matriarchal community. And because the women lead the herds, it's an extremely equal species. The male, female, and other gender species of elephants are often not even, you know, sort of fighting because of gender. There's a lot of equality, which is, again, amazing. And the third thing, this is very interesting, because one of the students that we worked with brought this up, where she said, "Are you called the Red Elephant Foundation because you're painting the elephant in the room red until people talk about it?" So I said, "Yes, that's it. Okay, this is amazing. I'm going to totally adopt this."
You're like, "I'm going to totally use that now."
Yeah.
I came up with that.
Thankfully, no. The one who asked us this, her name is Sumedha Ravi. And I hope she does get to listen to this so she knows I credited her.
Oh,
that's so beautiful how you explained how this name came about.
Yeah.
I didn't expect there to be so many layers of meaning behind this name.
So Kirti, just for our listeners, can you just let our listeners know exactly what Red Elephant Foundation does and its cause?
Sure. So we work as a civilian peace building agency for young people, working essentially towards creating gender equality and peace. And we do this through five things. The first thing we do is to tell stories of survivors and change makers as a bit of a milestone or a role model creation process. And then we also work towards digital advocacy. So we take up very topical campaigns that can then help people think about how they should respond to a situation around them. We also do tech for good. So I taught myself to code and I created a mobile app for survivors of gender-based violence. And that's something that we've been sort of positioning in our more recent activism and training and advocacy plugs. And we also do a lot of research because our activism is going to be terribly unfounded if we're not informed ourselves. So we do a lot of research that not only informs us, but also becomes white papers to be a bit of a library of resources. And finally, we also do trainings and workshops at schools, at colleges, at community spaces to help people kind of understand ways they can be pivoted towards gender equality, pivoted towards peace education. And
so you've mentioned a lot of things, Kirti, and it's not easy to sort of implement all of these things within a foundation. It does require a lot of effort to get something like this off the ground. So how did you go about doing all of this when you first started off?
I'll start by saying that one of the biggest reasons, a lot of people ask me, why don't you take one of these things and address them instead of doing all these things? Now, I personally believe in the theme of intersectionality, not just in understanding feminism, but also in approaches to implement feminism and approaches to understand patriarchy. Because if you look at an issue like, for instance, the biggest thing we're countering is violence, gender-based violence. And when you look at it, you have a very clear cause, you have a very clear bunch of actors, you also have very clear consequences. Now, if you isolate one and try to work on it in silos, you're not going to achieve results because, yes, you're going to work on this generation to build a future of nonviolent people, but what about those that are facing violence now? They're still facing patriarchy in the way they're being approached, in the way they're being treated, in the way they're being prevented from accessing support for what they've faced. And then if you're taking a bit of a curative approach and you're addressing what a survivor wants, you're forgetting a very future-facing approach to preventing violence altogether. And for me, choosing one over the other didn't feel right because I don't want to create a solution that's not even a solution in the long run or a solution that's not even a solution right now. So I wanted to be able to make a holistic approach. And the best part is that everything the Red Elephant Foundation does has been completely unfunded. It's only recently that we charge for the workshops that we do. So we travel entirely forwards based on the voluntary support of our volunteers. We have about 100 volunteers who are positioned all over the world and they're contributing in whatever ways they can. And the beautiful part of this is that because they're so driven by the cause, they want to give back. And that's the only thing that's keeping us going.
But at any point, Kirti, you know, out of curiosity, you know, I want to know more about this team. At any point, do you think volunteers have come to you and asked for pay and expected you to pay them for the work that they contributed to the cause?
Absolutely not. In fact, it's been beautiful because even at times when I've reached out to tell them that I want to reimburse them, or if I've sent money reimbursing them for their expenses, I've always had that return back. And it's always a bit of a volley. And the reason, it's amazing, right? The reason is that everybody who's part of the Red Elephant Foundation has seen the team as a family, has seen the work that we're doing as something we're doing for ourselves and for our future. And what's beautiful is that, you know, so we have a WhatsApp group where all of our volunteers spend time just kind of deconstructing things that happen every day. And everybody is sort of a huge stakeholder in that space. Like there's a sense of it's a safe space. It's a space we want to belong to. So touch wood, that's what's really amazing me too, even as I say it aloud.
Oh, that's beautiful, Kirti. Could you go into the Chalk Peace initiative that you started with the Red Elephant Foundation?
Sure. So when we started out, we were just a storytelling initiative. We would only interview people and put up their stories and do digital advocacy around those themes. But a point came when we used to also make it a very dedicated point to circulate these stories to teachers and so they could also get their students to read it. But then they would come back to us and say, okay, so now what? What do we do next? So the idea had a bit of a root in our minds. when the incident that happened that I talked about at the TED Talk, that really kind of kick-started the whole thing. So just to kind of paraphrase the incident, I was teaching a dance class where I happened to see an incident of bullying unfold before my eyes. And the nonchalance that the teacher offered, because apart from drawing the boy aside and saying, don't do this again, nothing was done for the young girl herself. And she was continuously under threat, because going by what she told me, this had happened before as well. So that made me kind of realize that we did have a huge opportunity that we could address. As a student of peace education myself, I've studied peace and conflict at my master's degree, I came to understand the value in using a peace education approach to effect change. And that gave birth to Chalk Peace. And we called it Chalk Peace, which is C-H-A-L-K-P-E-A-C-E, because that seemed like the quickest way to get across the idea of peace education.
Yep. Mm. And you also started, so Kirti, I think the whole interview is just going to be about every single initiative of yours, I think.
Yeah, it's going to be, oh, Kirti, you also started this, and Kirti, you started this. Can you tell?
But so you also started your own personal initiative, Femcyclopedia, where you aim to bring attention to unnoticed, powerful females. And I did go through your Instagram page, and there is a lot of reading that has to go behind this, because a lot of the characters that you have displayed on your Instagram page, I mean, it's not something we come across on a daily basis. So I'd like to know, like, how you managed to garner so much knowledge. You know, it really is amazing. Like, how do you come across these people?
So the basis of Femcyclopedia actually has its roots in about a year ago, when the CBSE, the Central Board for Secondary Education in India, deleted a chapter because it talked about a woman and what she did to fight the kind of imposition society had put on her for her caste identity. So just to kind of like paraphrase the story, is that this woman belonged to a community in Kerala called the Yerava community.
I belong to the Yerava community.
Right. So you must know the story of Nangeli then.
Oh, yes.
Right. So the CBSE had decided that Nangeli's story in the textbook being included was likely to cultivate obscene thoughts in the minds of a child, because what she did was to cut off her breasts to protest a breast tax.
Yep.
So
the breast tax, because Meenal doesn't know what it is, and many of our listeners also probably don't know, is basically women from these lower castes in Kerala, like the Irava community and other lower castes, were not allowed to cover their breasts when they walked around in public. Yeah, so they were not allowed to wear a sari blouse.
So they had to just walk around with...
Yes, and that was a thing. That was a thing in my great-grandmother's era.
Wow.
And so there was this king who had decided that he would make the best of this, saying that if some of these women wanted to cover themselves, they would have to pay a tax. And so she protested that tax by cutting off her breasts and giving it to him in a plantain leaf, and she bled herself to death. So for me, it was terrible, because it's completely cutting off this whole voice of women, this whole narrative of how women were oppressed. And again, it came back to intersectionality. So Femcyclopedia was again to kind of feminize the world's encyclopedias that ferry history, convert history to her story, and kind of put women back in the narrative. And I used to doodle very subconsciously when I was at law school, spacing out in class, because that's what I did. So doodling was an art form that I loved very much. And I realized that if I was going to revive history, the best way to grab attention of people would be to use something visual. And it didn't make sense for me to go Google a name and kind of download that picture and put it on Instagram. Like, anybody could do that. So I wanted to personalize the project, and that's when I started doodling these portraits. And as for like acquiring the kind of nose for the right kind of women, like the obscure women, and bringing them out, that's something I love challenging myself with doing, because it's very difficult to find the women themselves. So I started off with something very, very stupid. I went on Google and I said, badass women in history.
did you find me and Ankita?
I wish I could see, yes, but then again, you're those pages, right?
Not yet.
I'm just kidding.
No, I'm gonna correct you right there. So the men wrote those pages, so all the awesome women were left out. Yeah. So I would really find compilations that listed the same women over and over again. So there was Eleanor Roosevelt, there was Margaret Thatcher, there was Indira Gandhi, there was Sarojini Naidu. There was Anne Frank, and that's it. So and now I sort of spend a lot of time in libraries. I sort of look at history textbooks that nobody's touched in days. And then I kind of identify a woman. And then the best part is when I know the name of the woman and I Google them, there is information. But just the question of accessing these profiles is what's difficult. So, yeah, it's an everyday process and I love it. I just love it.
Wow. I am just like on the Femcyclopedia Instagram page right now, actually. And I just came across the art that you drew about Kenat Riaz and Shazia Ramzan, Malala's fellow pupils at the school. And Ankita, just like, and even for our listeners, it's very interesting because it brings to light the fact that Malala went through a lot to get to Oxford, but also her fellow colleagues and companions also went through the same turmoil. And they're actually studying, well, hopefully going to study nursing at Edinburgh as well. And I just read that. It's like truth bombs. And it's like, it's amazing.
And along the same lines, Kirti, you might actually find this interesting. I was in India last month, and as a gift for my niece, what I bought was this book called Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls. Mm-hmm. It's a compilation of 100 women from history and even from the present who've done amazing things, but some of them went unnoticed. Some of them had to go through a lot of trouble to get to where they are. And it's just 100 beautiful stories. And I really did not want to part with that book. I was so selfish. I did not want to give my niece the book. But in the end, I had to part with it. So if you get time, maybe you can check it out. It's an amazing book. And it's quite similar to what you do. And they have, hand-painted caricatures of these women, etc.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, Ankita, actually, I'm guilty of the same thing. Because I went out to buy a couple of copies of the book for some of my friend's daughters. And I saw it, and there was just one copy. I picked it up for myself, and I told my friends, sorry, there wasn't anything on the shelf.
So you have seen the book then?
I have seen the book. Yes, I do have it with me.
Perfect.
I have the feeling that I'm going to have to run because I'm going to be chased down for saying there weren't copies at the store.
For admitting that you kept it for yourself.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, just kind of going back to something you raised, Meena, the reason I specifically chose Kainat and Shehnaz to sort of tell their story on the day Malala was shot was because it's not just the fact that these two girls have gone through the same thing, but here's what's interesting. These two girls went back to study in the same school when Malala was given a way out of the city. And I find that to be a little bit of a difficult thing for me to take because, of course, this is not with any discredit to Malala. It's amazing that she shows the resilience that she shows. But why are we ignoring the other two girls too, right?
Always, yeah. Because we were speaking to Ajit George from the Shanti Bhavan project the other day, and he was talking about the Netflix documentary Daughters of Destiny that follows five girls from Shanti Bhavan school into adulthood and into, you know, the amazing people they've become in life. But he said that, I don't want to brag, but almost every other child in Shanti Bhavan is exactly the same. Every other child shows that much aptitude, but we only focused on these five children doesn't mean that these other kids are not as smart. And if you want to get the story of a Shanti Bhavan kid, I would actually encourage you to talk to someone who did not get that limelight.
Yeah, you know, that's actually very true because we tend to get led by what the media says about certain names in certain places. And we think that's the end of it. So
yeah. And Kirti, you know, you like to draw, you write books and you write plays. And well, you just Kirti. But apart from finding the time to do all of these, how do you find the inspiration? Because you are a very busy person, and to just sit down to write or to draw, you need some. I think you would need some downtime to sit at your desk and be creative. So how do you work around all of this?
So I'll be very honest in telling you that I'm genuinely not that busy. 90% of my work just involves looking at my laptop screen and hoping things just happen. And that's typically my strategy.
It really doesn't look like
that. Is exactly, that is exactly what I do.
Just wing it.
That is exactly what I do. I just wing it because, you know, a lot of things that I've created or written or just kind of produced as a piece have been things that have been in response. I choose not to react to things that happen to me. I choose to respond to them. So I think it's just that decision to consciously respond and to make something actionable out of it is what makes me do these things. That's the inspiration part of it. But how these things happen, I have no idea. I have no idea, because the play that I wrote, the first play that I wrote that was produced earlier this year on Anne Frank's birthday, it just happened to me over half an hour. It was just words that flew out of, like, I just typed it out. And the next morning when I saw it, I said, wow, did I really do that? It's kind of scary.
So we did joke earlier that this interview is turning out to be, Kirti, this initiative that you started and then this other initiative that you started. So I think before we go much deeper into more of your other initiatives and achievements, we need to share a timeline of events with our listeners, because they might be thinking this is a little bit of an information overload. So from the beginning, Kirti, you went to law school and then you worked at a corporate environment for a while. And then immediately you jumped to volunteering. I mean, you first of all started volunteering with the UN online volunteering system and a couple of other organizations in Chennai. Yeah. So what drove this sudden shift? I mean, studying law is not a piece of cake. So you went through it, you graduated, you got a job, and in a month you jumped to volunteering. How did that happen?
Sorry, I had to laugh at that because I you know, so law school in India is very different. At least where I went to is very different from law school in most other parts of the world. I suppose Indian education is also very different because the emphasis is on how much you know, not how you use what you know. So it's kind of, like one strategy through 5 years that you employ if you've seen that it works, and that's about it. So I was never...
So you became a robot by the end of your law degree.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you get a chance, please take a look at this video on engineering students that was made by All India Bakchod. They actually kind of talk about the same thing. So it was never part of the plan to be a lawyer. My dad's a lawyer, my brother's a lawyer, and now I have a law degree. So three of us sold our souls to the devil, and my mom does yoga. That's the joke. It was never a part of my plan. I was never going to practice in a court of law. It's this Indian mentality of you do something that you can fall back on when you fail in life, which is the level of confidence your parents have in you at first, and your society has in you at first. So the thing is, I just had to check the box of finishing with law school, and I did hear that corporate law offers you a lot of money, so that was why I applied to go. And I realized that if you were going to be paid that much, they needed your soul in exchange, so that's why I ran out in a month. And I ran out penniless. My parents were super encouraging and said, look, take all the time you want, do whatever you want. Now that you have your law degree, you can experiment. I'm like, okay, that's how it works. And so I met with an Indian Foreign Services officer, an IFS officer, because my career choices were pivoted towards humanitarian services, and I wanted to know how I would get it. And he said I was too young and too unqualified to be part of the UN already, so I could start by volunteering online. So that was how it got started.
Okay, and there was also a point in your life where you wanted to study medicine, Kirti, and that was because you wanted to help people. And I also had similar feelings when I had joined medical school, because, you know, it was the idea that, you know, you can kill two birds with one stone. You can earn money and at the same time have the opportunity to help your community and your society. But it's only now, you know, during the course of the last couple of years that I realized that you don't have to be a doctor to be active in your community. There are so many other ways you can be part of a social change and, you know, even further, a global change without having to worry about earning money. There are so many things that you can do. So what would you say to our young listeners who are tuning in right now, who have similar aspirations, but also have concerns about how they can earn money and perhaps even have a stable life?
I think the first thing to understand is that so long as you have any skill set that can be used to make a change, if you're an artist, draw meaningful things that make people think. If you're a writer, write things that again make people think, or give people room to articulate their writing by maybe teaching them to write, to tell their stories. So I don't believe that any skill is useless. I don't believe that any skill can sort of stop the buck with change making. So the question then comes down to how you can use your skills. So, you know, those times in the day when you're sort of, even if you're in a really, really busy job and you have really long hours of work, you do have time in between where you take breaks. So how about if you spent even 5 to 10 minutes of that to engage in something meaningful, whether it's learning something, whether it's listening to a podcast like this one, because you're always learning things and at some point that's going to come in handy. Or maybe even just sign up to teach someone English online on Skype. There's so many organizations that do that. I was part of one myself that's called Pax Populi that helps me that helped me teach students in Afghanistan to speak in English, which then helps them do TOEFL and IELTS exams and sort of.
Wow, and you did this. You did this online.
Yes, through Skype, quite like our sessions. Yeah. Yeah, so it's amazing, right? You don't have to go anywhere. You can take a 1 hour over the lunch break thing, and then you're always making impact. So the question is how, you know, if you could just kind of look at waking up every morning and thinking about how you can make the day better for yourself and one more person before you go to sleep, however it is, even if it's a random act of kindness, like buying someone a meal, just go and do it.
This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free Blackstone 8-piece accessory kit when you buy a Blackstone 28-inch griddle. Plus, get two free select Craftsman V20 tools when you buy an RP brushless drill and impact driver combo kit. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
And Kirti, what you do right now, it's not seen as a path that makes a lot of money. I mean, nonprofits, I'm not just talking about Red Elephant, but many other ventures that you're invested in. It, nonprofits, unlike corporations, focus on other elements of growth rather than the financial side of things, or just the financial side of things. So how do you ensure that your various ventures are sustainable in themselves?
Sure. So I actually am a freelance writer, because that's how I have been sustaining myself throughout.
So that's how you ate all that cheese today.
Yes, exactly. I was just going to say that. Yes, exactly. So it's really amazing, because being a freelancer also gives you the space to figure out how your day is going to go. And the deliverables are also deadline driven. So you can kind of space yourself out between now and your deadline and work really sort of in a way that kind of ties in perfectly. So it's kind of difficult at first, because when you start off as a freelancer, you're really looking for work. And it takes about 2 years to sort of leave your imprint enough for people to take you seriously and give you more work. But I would say that 2 years is a crunch period for anybody who's starting out anywhere, because even if you do have a paying job, you're still at the lowest rung of the pecking order and you're still kind of making your way up. So I would say 2 years, no matter what it is that you're choosing, give yourself the courage and the strength to bear those 2 years. And after that, things become a lot easier.
Right. And you know, Meenal just mentioned that she wanted to kill two birds with one stone by becoming a doctor. And we see a lot of people who always say that I want to settle down first and then give my time, energy and even money to other people who need help. But what is your take on this? Because that's the complete opposite of what you did with your life. You know, do you think there's a balance you can strike if you have this career going for you? Or in general, what do you think about this?
I've always been told that you cannot fasten another person's oxygen mask until you fasten your own. And a lot of people have always told me to kind of stop, build up my resources and then get back on this. Now, I have a big problem with that, because I am a very ambitious person, and I know that contentment and a sense of complacency can kill my ambition. So that's reasonably why I have never sort of said I will go in to do 5 years of corporate work, or say 10 years of earning and then throw myself into work on the other side. I think I wouldn't have ever come back, because I'm very comfortable in inertia. Like if I'm eating cheese one slice, I can finish the whole packet like I did just now. So it's a bad idea to put me in one pattern.
Oh, that's funny. You know, as someone, I'm someone who's obsessed with Latin American culture, and I love speaking Spanish as well. And I speak Spanish for obvious reasons, because I was raised in Gibraltar, but I just love the Spanish culture. So I was pretty excited to hear that you studied in Costa Rica. So how did you end up there, from someone from Chennai in India? How did you end up to South America?
Sure. So I actually studied a degree by research. It was a master's in sustainable peace in a contemporary world by the University of Peace in Costa Rica. I've always wanted to study something to do with peace and conflict, essentially because even as a law student, much as I spaced out in class, I was very drawn to international humanitarian law, which addresses conflict and the whole element of post-conflict justice and rebuilding of societies. And I wanted to kind of delve deeper on the non-law side to sort of look at how policies are made and how different strategies are structured to create peace. But I couldn't find anything apart from mainstream political science or war studies, and that was kind of one-sided. And also region specific. So this was the one university that offered the degree. So I just jumped up to take it up. I didn't get to stay in Costa Rica for the course, though. I was doing it as a degree by research, so I did much of it outside of Costa Rica.
Okay, and I'm just curious, did you speak any Spanish or?
No hablo español.
No hablo español.
No, I did learn Spanish for all of 1 month. So now I can kind of say things like a mí me gusta.
Okay.
Yeah, that's as far as my Spanish goes.
That means I like.
A bit left out.
I like, yes.
I'm feeling a bit left out over here.
No, but, I tried to put it for test. So I went to the Spanish bakery in Chennai and I just pointed at things like, a mí me gusta, and that worked so well.
There's a Spanish bakery in Chennai?
Used to be, sadly not.
There's everything in Chennai.
Wow.
Chennai has everything. Yes. Yeah.
I have to go to Chennai. But, you know, I went to Brazil and there was an endless list of concerns from my parents and my family that, you know, Brazil is not safe. It's a country we're not aware of. But, you know, somehow I still managed to jump on a flight and go on my little adventure. But it was, you know, it was to do with my medical studies as well. So I was going to ask you what kind of people you met in Costa Rica, but that question is kind of redundant now. But I do want to ask you that in your eyes, how important is it not just to travel, but also to experience these sort of different cultures and different ideas from different parts of the world? Do you think it's important to understand? Do you think this is important to understand the world from a sort of wider lens?
I think it's absolutely important because we're now in such a global world that anything that's happening outside of you know, for instance, outside of Chennai does concern me. Anything that happens outside of India does concern me because sooner or later I am going to be affected by it somehow. So I think that's the first reason why anybody needs to be cued in on anything that's happening around them. But the second thing is now we're in such a diverse world that identities have become sub-identities, which have become sub-sub-identities because of so much of interaction that the one-size-fits-all approach that we started with by the end of the Second World War is no longer valid actually to start with. Because, you know, if you had an approach that worked in the United States, it wouldn't work in, say, Europe, or definitely wouldn't work in South Asia or Southeast Asia. And part of the problems that we've created today, whether it's the war in Afghanistan or in Iraq, has all centered because there's been a perspective of democracy has worked here, so it's going to work there. And so kind of let's fit it in. So if we need to understand the world, we need to create solutions that are going to change the way problems have been approached so far. We need to be intersectional, and you can't be intersectional unless you have empathy. You can't have empathy unless you know about the other people around you.
And can we just talk about how from Costa Rica you ended up in Washington, D.C. in 2011 to accept your U.S. Presidential Services Medal from Obama himself? I mean, it makes us so proud to be talking to someone who's accomplished so much, Kirti. But tell us about that experience. This is just so new to us.
So it's kind of the chronology is a little skewed. So I actually received my award through the consulate in Chennai because I wasn't obviously able to hop on a plane the day it was announced.
Right.
I wasn't given like prior information, so I couldn't really, you know, just kind of get up and go. And then I went to Costa Rica. Sorry, I did my degree from Costa Rica in 2014 and 15. So the award from President Obama was because of my work with an organization called Delta Women, which is US-based but works for women and children in Nigeria. And so in 2011, what's interesting was we created the first possibly most impactful social media-based change-making project, which the UN picked up at some point and made me speak about it. So we pulled up 1 month-long digital media campaign with which we irritated the Nigerian Education Ministry into opening the first school in a village in Delta State called Oko-Ejirogu. So it was really interesting because this village did not have a school for 30 years before that. The children used to have to go to the next village, the closest village, which was 25 or 30 kilometers away, depending upon the routes they were forced to take. So it was a huge experience because I had just begun and I began to have terrible doubts about my career choices. Because like I said, it's those first 2 years that really matter. I graduated in 2010. And by the end of 2011, I thought I would probably have to settle for maybe Clown College or something because I was getting nowhere. And then this award came out of that and I realized, okay, this is a sign. It's probably something I will have to spend time dedicating myself to. But I can do this.
And you know, you mentioned that you were involved in opening the first ever school in Okoijorogu in Nigeria. So can you just tell us a bit more about this team and how you went about seeing this project to fruition?
So in the run-up to that, I was part of Delta Women for a good amount of time. And Elsie Reed, the founder, found it fit to kind of appoint me as the head of digital campaigns because she felt that I did show promise. And so I headed the team. And then one day she received an email from somebody in Nigeria telling her about the situation. So she wrote to me with the photographs and the email from that person saying, we really need to do something. This is a bad situation. So at that time, social media being used for advocacy in the scale that it's being used now was unheard of. And so when we came up with the plan, we decided to sort of do a little video every day, tell the stories of the children themselves, and keep sort of pushing forward and telling the Nigerian ministry to do something about it. It was a very interesting process because we were a bunch of volunteers who had never met each other, who probably hadn't even spoken on Skype as much. And we were just names and email IDs to each other. But we had sort of just come together across the world. There were people from Pakistan. There were people from Alaska in the United States. There was a person from Australia. There was a person from New Zealand. And we were kind of coming together to help children in a village in Nigeria, children we may just never even be able to meet, know the names of, or even recognize, even if we saw them anywhere outside. So yeah, it was an interesting project. It was a very moving project, to say the least.
And Kirti, this next question I'm going to ask you is based on a little bomb that you dropped earlier. So we've already discussed how you're a CEO, a lawyer, writer, artist, and activist. But on top of everything, you even coded an app called Sahas for survivors of gender-based violence. And this is an app that has helped individuals across 196 countries. So I'm actually curious to know if, on top of everything you do, how did you find the time to learn how to code? Because I've tried my hand at it, and I'm not so sure I'm good at coding.
Wow. So the thing is, the journey of coding was actually, again, completely unplanned. Like I said, I've just been winging these things. but last year in May, there was this friend of mine who had moved to the United Kingdom after being married. And the entire time that she was married, between January of 2015 and May of 2016, she was in a horribly abusive marriage. Her husband would beat her, would lock her up, and would not let her sort of communicate with anyone on the phone. And even if she spoke with her family, she was allowed 5 minutes and he would hover around. And her emails were always being read and everything. So this one day, on the 14th of May last year, he'd come home and then he had to run back to work. So he forgot to lock her in. And so she let herself out of the house and took whatever money she could find, took her phone, and just got onto the first train that she could find that she could buy herself a ticket for. And then she just kind of went up and down the train, just going nowhere, not even sure where to go. This was all at 10:30 p.m. Indian time. Now, I usually sleep for about 2 to 3 hours every night, but that night I slept at 10 p.m., which is completely unlike me. And she's tried to call me. She's left 31 missed calls and 16 messages, and I haven't been able to. Yeah. And I haven't been able to get through to her. And the next morning when I called her, it says that the number is out of access. But later I came to know that she didn't want to call her parents at night because they were both heart patients, and that kind of a call would really devastate them. So she managed to switch train after train after train until somebody kind of realized that she was in trouble and took her to a shelter. And she came back to India a couple of weeks after that. So this was a bit of an eye-opener because, you know, like this girl had never moved out of Chennai until she was married. And she was in a country that she'd never seen because her husband was busy locking her up. So what would we do for women like that who are relying on friends back at home who for whatever reason are not accessible? So that led me to create a web-based app using an Ushahidi mapping process to find help across 9 verticals across 196 countries because it can happen anywhere. And then I realized that, you know, in a situation like hers where her husband would monitor her computer activity, using a web app would be impossible because of the history and everything. But a smartphone was less easy to manipulate, which was also true in her case. So I went to a couple of corporate houses and I asked them for help in coding the app. And they promised me, but nothing came of it for a variety of reasons. They were just not able to provide, like, it wasn't even a priority for them. So I decided if I needed to do this, I would have to teach myself to code. So I started learning using Coursera, and I cried every day. I really, really cried. And then by the end of it, I thought I was fit to be an engineer that anybody would employ. And then when I coded the first piece, I also wanted to spit on myself for the rubbish I coded. And then I realized that coding for dummies, quite like myself, could be made easier if you have what's called a software development kit, which is like a pre-made piece of code that you can then kind of just import and customize to suit your needs. So I used a little bit of that, and then used a little bit of my own coding, and I created the app, and I call it Sahas, which means courage, because even getting out of an abusive situation or abusive relationship or place where you face violence is an act of resistance and courage.
Now, this is a classic example of you using your anger to create something out of it. I mean, obviously you needed a lot of drive to go behind this project and see it to fruition. I'm also curious to know, how does Sahas work? How does it help people?
So Sahas is a comprehensive resource again. It lists out services across 9 verticals in all parts of the world, about 196 countries. And of course, it also includes other regions that are not officially recognized as countries. Now, what it does is it allows the user to just log on, open up the app and find out wherever she is and find out help across the vertical that she needs that's closest to her. Now, the thing is, we've not been able to populate too many resources. It's only about 20,000 resources across these 196 countries because I'm very keen on sort of verifying that they're providing the service before I list them. Because sometimes when it's donor-driven, programs can be cut down and they may not be able to offer certain services and all of that. So that kind of led me to create the first part. And then I realized that, okay, and I'm giving people this information, but how do they use it? What kind of rights are they going to have, right? Like, people don't know the rights they have. I'm a lawyer by education, so I can tell you the rights that I have, but that's not true of anybody on the street who is the TG of the app itself. So I created a legal library, and then like that, a medical library, and then again, a survivor library. Like, what do you do if you face violence? How do you prevent a situation of violence from escalating? How do you get out of it? How do you seek help? And then I created a bystander intervention section as well, which is a bunch of resources for people who can intervene to create a bit of a distraction or a delay or any of those things in a situation of violence.
And Kirti, we just released episode 50, and somehow Ankita and I got into discussion about feminism and how we always see that women are always ready to stand up for their fellow female, you know, members of society. But we got into the discussion about how we can help men in terms of setting the standards for other men on how to treat everyone equally. So what are your thoughts here on this? Because I would like to know, like, what does feminism actually mean to you? And apart from just focusing on equal rights for women, how can we empower men rather than just make them feel sort of intimidated to bring a change?
Thank you so much for asking that, because most people who focus on feminism essentially look at the woman's end of things. So I personally believe feminism is equality of all genders, not just men and women. And so sort of looking beyond the binary would mean that regardless of your gender or sexual orientation or any of those identity elements, you are equal. Even if you're different, you're equal. In terms of the fact that you do have to have the equal opportunities, the equal access, and all of those things. Now, when it comes to men, now, of course, you have amazing men who have stood up for women, who have stood up against violence, and who really sort of walked the extra mile. Now, the thing is, in having worked with young boys and men, one of the things I've understood is that men are consciously aware of the fact that they have a power called patriarchy, a kind of power called privilege, which is going to be taken away from them if we're going to try to equalize society. Now, if you really take away something from them, it's always important that you understand that you have to make them feel empowered in spite of the fact that something's been taken away. Now, I'm not going to give up my power if I know that it's going to obviously disempower me and put me in a weak place. I'm not going to be so willing to come down from a place that society has given me as a bit of a luxury, because I'm enjoying it. I'm you know, benefiting from it. So the best way to do is to make them understand that they are stakeholders in the larger process, because violence and patriarchy really affect men as well. For instance, in a classic example in an Indian household, A man is automatically seen as a breadwinner. So if he has to be, if he's a boy, he's automatically required to have a job that pays a six-figure salary. He can't go off that track. He can't explore maybe wildlife photography. He can't just get out of that space and do his own thing. And then it's also very, very sad because a man is not allowed to cry. A man is not allowed to wear pink. Like, these are microaggressions that affect an individual's choice and affect the freedom of their life and their individual space as well. So I think if we're able to come from that space, help them understand and recognize that they are receiving the wrong side of patriarchy too, although they think they're receiving the privilege, then I think it's greater to be able to make an impact and work with them.
Kirti, I think we're on the right topic now to slowly move into your various theories, starting with your views on intersectional feminism. So I've seen that in your writings and your work, especially in the article you wrote titled Culture, Circumstance and Consequence, you talk of the woman who was twice removed from society and doubly oppressed. A woman like you, a woman like me, oppressed on the basis of caste. Or color. So you speak mainly of the Dalit woman who was first discriminated against on account of her caste and then on account of her gender. So she's different from a regular Indian woman who faces gender-based discrimination. And this ideology, it also applies to other oppressed castes, classes, or even minorities like the Black woman, for example, who's discriminated based on color first and gender second. So based on this, could you please delve deeper into the concept of intersectional feminism for anyone out there who might be listening and not aware of the concept at all?
Sure. So I suppose for me, you're either an intersectional feminist or you're not at all a feminist, because I don't believe that, you know, it's like the UN's latest tagline for the Sustainable Development Goals, right? Like, leave no one behind. Now, one of the biggest problems that the way I experienced intersectionality is in understanding the reservations and the affirmative action that was done for the benefit of certain castes in India. What I did happen to notice was that those among the castes that were economically advantaged. For instance, within one caste, you have people who have a greater economic capacity and those who have a lower economic capacity. Now, it was the ones that were already economically advanced that were taking the benefits of a program that was essentially created for the others at the other end of the spectrum. And that's terrible, because the government is probably convinced that we've been able to fill so many places from representation of so many castes, but on the other side, the real ones that need the benefit of that policy are not getting it. So intersectionality simply means to sort of understand how different identity factors and markers come together to create an individual's personal experience. It could be a gender experience, it could be a religious experience, or it could just be a nationality or an identity experience in a person's family. So what I would say is that when you look at intersectionality, it helps you understand with empathy what a Dalit woman goes through, and like you perfectly said, what an African American woman would go through in the United States of America because of her color and then her gender. So I think it's important that all of us cultivate a space of intersectionality, no matter what it is that we do, because we're always interacting with people, we're always interacting with identities, and our interactions are extremely unique because we're different people to different people. And if we can come from that empathy, it's easier to build peace.
And I also came across your peacetime, wartime continuum that you discussed in several interviews and in your TED talk. Something that seemed sort of glaringly obvious to me, but I never, you know, sort of thought about it as a concept in itself. So what made you think of this?
Sure. So what made me sort of delve deeper into this was because it was around the time of the Arab Spring when my career trajectory actually began. It was I was reading about instances that happened to Mona al-Dahawi and then to Lara Logan and a lot of other people in different parts of the Middle East, whether it was Egypt or Tunisia. And the first thing that made me understand that sexual violence was taking place at a large scale was reading up on this website called Women Under Siege Project, which lists out specific conflict zones and the kind of violence that went on. And it made me understand that in all of these societies that they had listed out, there was a certain social salience around a woman's body. A woman's body was considered almost like the vehicle of that society's honor or that society's identity or whatever else it might be, whatever they hold sacred. And so so in the context of conflict, defilement of that which is held sacred automatically pivoted around a woman's body. And we were not, most rhetoric around that was not looking at this one critical tool, because if we can understand exactly why sexual violence is being so effectively used as a targeted weapon in a war, then it's easier to speak to those that perpetrated and then deconstruct it and prevent it, or at least bring it to an end in a conflict that's going on. Because part of sort of diagnosing a problem and approaching a problem is really calling it what it is. So that's essentially what motivated me to put that down in print.
You know, and another topic that we always on Desi Outsiders seem to be gravitating towards is the quality of content produced in the Indian film industry, especially concerning the roles of the female artists. And we recently had Karan Talwar from Bollywood Gandu on our show just 2 weeks ago, and he shared an anecdote which you might actually find interesting, Kirti. So he said that there was a billboard very close to his home that had weathered a storm recently, and it unexpectedly exposed this poster from about 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, it showcased actors like Shah Rukh Khan, Salman Khan, and Ajay Devgan getting ready to receive an award or something. And it's so interesting to note that in those 10 years, we've gone from Madhuri Dixit and Aishwarya Rai to Priyanka Chopra to Anushka Sharma and Alia Bhatt. But the male leads have almost always just remained constant till date. So you developed a version of the Bechdel test for Indian cinema, mostly surrounding the representation of women, more than what kind of actors are, you know, getting removed from the industry. It's about the representation of women in Indian cinema. So how would you explain this concept to, say, a child?
Sure. So I would start by saying, when you're watching a piece of a media, whatever it is, whether it's a film, whether it's a song from a film, because the Indian film industry is in love with music and videos around music. What are you seeing? What are the 10 things that you can notice? And I've actually sat down with young children from different schools, showing them videos and asked them to write down things they've noticed. 9 out of 10 times, they've noticed the hero either hitting, pounding, pinching, chasing after, pulling clothes or hair off the heroine, all through a song sequence, all in the name of just kind of patawing her, which in Hindi actually translates to mean wooing her. And eventually, so this girl is seen getting furious and she's making all the angry expressions and gestures at the man. Eventually turns around and says that she loves the man and everything. So the children then create this kind of a warped idea of how it is to be pursued in love and how to pursue in love. And that's translated not necessarily in every context, but in many, many contexts. So in the workshops that we do, I ask them, is this how you like to be treated? I ask the girls, would you like to be treated like this? I always get a no. And then I ask the boys, is this how you would like to be treated? I mean, if somebody liked you, would you like to have them pinch you or hit you or do any of those things that the hero was seen doing? And they say no. So, and then we have a very open discussion about how we can kind of unpack the perceptions of each other and how films are kind of creating this bizarre idea and how we're tending to bite into them in the kind of language we use. And it's beautiful because the children themselves arrive at these conclusions and deconstruct it and create their own kind of level playing ground for all the genders in their classroom. But the version of the Bechdel test that I was really sort of harping on was essentially because, number one, the conventional notion of the Bechdel test is really to look at the narrative arc and the kind of conversations that are being had in the process. But I think that's really offering too low a threshold to evaluate films, because women are not just meant to just be there to have like one tiny 10-second conversation, which could still qualify.
Like Taboo in Hum Saath Saath Hai. Meenal and I just recently watched the movie together, and right? We were like, literally her role is to serve them food.
Exactly. And but that would still kind of fulfill the Bechdel test, because she's, you know, not even having a conversation to be evaluated for the Bechdel test. So it struck me that the test was kind of failing, not just the film set or subset of films that it was made for, but also the larger theme itself in general. So when I watched films, I kind of noted all the problems that I had with them. And I made movie going a very unpleasant experience for a lot of friends and family who now do not go with me. So seeing the kind of responses I had, I was able to kind of frame the questions I would want to ask before I watched a film. And now,
you know, This is interesting because you made the movie-going experience difficult for a lot of friends and family. My mom was raving about this film called Bahubali, and almost every person in my Facebook feed would talk about it, and they would say, Bahubali is an amazing, epic movie. Everyone has to watch it. And my husband and I decided, okay, we'll watch it now. And I don't know if you watched the movie. It came out in three multiple languages, I believe, or four languages. I don't know if you remember the scene where he quite literally sort of molests and undresses and rape, but I don't know what other people would call it. But it did look like this man was basically chasing her around, undressing her and making her more beautiful, feminizing her. Like giving her coal under her eyes or lipstick on her lips and making her more beautiful so that he could, in the end, just sleep with her. I don't know if you remember the scene that I'm talking about, Kirti.
Oh, I haven't watched the film, Ankita, I'll be honest, because I never book my tickets. I mean, in India, it's a big deal. You book your tickets for the first day and the first show.
Yeah,
I always make sure to just wait until the first reviews are in. And if I so much as see a squeak of sexism, I don't even turn in that direction.
Wow.
We saw this and we were like, how is this even allowed? And I went up to my mom and said, you watched this movie and you asked me to watch it and you said it was amazing. Did you realize what was going on in that song sequence? It was basically just, this girl is a fighter and she's a warrior princess sort of thing. And this man just follows her around, undresses her from her, you know, fighter garments and makes her wear something quite similar to a sari, which is bright red. And she looks in the water and she looks at her reflection and thinks that she's beautiful now. I'm like, what?
Which is one of the biggest problems I have, Akiva, with the way Indian films are certified and even passed. You might have come across the controversy with lipstick under my burqa. Yeah, mm-hmm. I can't for the life of me understand why a very basic open conversation around themes of marital rape and women's sexuality is taboo. But a man defiling a woman on screen is just a show of masculinity and can be excused. It's a terrible, terrible thing.
Kirti, it really has been a truly educational and experience for both of us, and really has broadened our horizons. We're really so grateful to you for taking the time to educate and inspire us. And we know that you have a very busy schedule, so to squeeze us in, it really is very humbling.
Oh, thank you so much for thinking of me. I mean, it's amazing to be able to connect with the two of you, to align with the vision that the both of you have. And I will be honest, I was not busy. I was just winging things.
Thank you, Kirti. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, ladies.
And thank you, as always, dear listeners, for tuning in this week. We feel that talking to Kirti has been truly inspirational for us, especially in terms of how you can turn a horrible, negative experience to fuel your drive to do something good for other people. So we hope that you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed recording it with Kirti.
And thank you once again, Kirti, for being so honest and sharing your story, which almost moved me to tears. You went through something no child should have to experience, and we commend your strength in overcoming this injustice and using your voice for the betterment of our society.
You can follow Kirti on social media at Kirti Jayakumar, and you can find us at Desi Outsiders. So do send in your queries, comments, and feedback to mail@desioutsiders.com. And until next week, I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenal.
And we are the Desi Outsiders.